call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Representative Purcell, have you had a chance to review the minutes for March 14th? And if so, can you move their approval?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I am reviewing them now, and I would like to move their approval.
Representative Purcell moves the minutes for March 14th, 2023. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. We're going to move some things around on the agenda, and first up is going to be House File 1828 from Chair Hansen. Chair Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, I would move House File 1828 be laid over for possible inclusion in a Bowser bus bill, maybe.
And I believe, Mr. Chair, you have an A1 author's amendment as well.
I do. I would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like. This provides some clarifying adjectives in the bill and adds a definition of restored prairie that used to be in law.
Representative Hansen moves the A1 amendment to get the form in the bill he would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no, and the motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. 1828 as amended is a policy bill that relates to Board of Water and Soil Resources and Soil and Water Conservation Districts. I have two testifiers with me. John Jashke, the Executive Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and then Sheila Vianney with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Districts. And if Mr. Jashke could come forward.
Great. We'll move testimony. First is Director Jashke from the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. Welcome back to the committee. Director Jashke, please say your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. John Jashke, Executive Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Director Jashke, can you move the microphone a little bit closer? It's a little bit difficult to hear you. Thanks.
Is that better?
That's much better.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the author indicated, this is a bill that has several comprehensive changes to various parts of our authorities and our programs. I'll go through them somewhat briefly. If you have any questions, feel free to ask any questions. I will try and note the pieces that were adjusted through the amendment as well. On page 2, there is a provision that updates the Camp Ripley program that we work with the National Guard on to acquire conservation easements in concert with their interests for both natural resources as well as military purposes. We have an adjustment in the middle of page 2 that would allow us to enter into grant agreements and other agreements with tribal nations as well as others to bring federal money and or other resources to these enterprises that would help us do our work. At the top of page 3, we have a provision that allows the agency to bring together groups in a voluntary fashion to identify and update conservation practices. This expands the suite of those practices that would be reviewed and developed and then shared. On middle of page 3, a similar provision for native vegetation. We have a responsibility that has been linked to policy language in the Environment Natural Resources Trust Bill as well as the Outdoor Heritage Fund that requires us to establish these standards, and this language would allow us to do that in a more explicit way and transparent way as well as bringing expertise from others and acknowledging that in the process. On the page 3 and 4, there's a conservation easement account that we are seeking an adjustment for, and this is the first piece is just to update the terminology in the top of page 4. On the center of page 4, this would allow us to use this fund on an as-needed basis only to repair and replace structures that are either damaged or have need of repair. The ability to tap that fund so that we can use it before that situation gets worse and costs more down the road. On page 5, there is a establishment of a habitat-friendly utility program, and there's also a budget recommendation in the governor's budget on this as well. Allows us to work with utility companies, and we've got a pilot underway with solar installations to establish habitat, specifically pollinator habitat, in and around those areas and identify that benefit to the public that those private landscapes can also provide in addition to the energy benefits. This would allow us to do this with other utility operators, transmission lines, pipelines, things like that. The bottom of page three, there's a habitat enhanced landscape program. This is the sort of a companion in some ways to the lawns to legumes piece that was passed earlier out of this body and onto the floor. That would allow us to work in neighborhood areas and in public landscapes along boulevards and things to establish, again, native species aimed at, you know, biodiversity and pollinator-specific types of practices. Beginning in the middle of page six, there are some a package of changes here that would adjust the state's cost share program that the soil and water conservation districts carry out to allow it to be more comprehensive and also to make it work in a more streamlined fashion so we can bring federal money that has become available in bigger ways than previously through the Inflation Reduction Act, as well as some expected funding from the state via the governor's budget. There was, I think, one or two adjustments to that in the language that is in the amendment. And I think we're fine with that language in the amendment. The one that we've noted and communicated to the author is that the rule language that would repeal some of the rules that are specific to this program, we'd like to take another look at that to make sure they fit with the way the statute has been adjusted as well. So I'll just page through that to top of page nine. This establishes a soil health practices program, you know, for the types of things that we know are important for agricultural producers to provide, you know, public benefits in form of climate and carbon sequestration, as well as water quality. And of course, if it's done right, it can be a production benefit as well for those producers. This creates a mechanism to put those funds into, and there is a recommendation in the governor's budget for this as well. On to top of page 10, I see there was an additional item here identified in the amendment to define restored prairie. We support that. You can see there's also a grassland definition that's also included in this definition. It would allow us to use those definitions in our Reinvest in Minnesota program, which has been around for quite a long period of time and has very successfully accomplished a number of hundreds, actually, if not thousands, of landscape restorations via that easement program. We also are looking to create a working lands easement program, which is listed there at the bottom of page 10, to again bring in some federal funding to match some state funding. We look at the bottom of page 11. This is one policy change to the Wetland Conservation Act. It's just a mechanism that would allow us to do mitigation for the purposes of both public waters and wetlands, and the federal requirements that go with that. For example, a linear project that crosses a creek, there's wetlands that are impacted as well as maybe some of the creek. We can use this program, if the permits allow, to mitigate those impacts through the wetland banking program. And I think I did miss one other change on the watershed district statute, which is let me see where that's at now, Madam Chair. Oh, yes, on the bottom of page 8, this would just simply correct what was long held to be the case that watershed district boards, you know, after review and approval by those via public notice, including agencies, would approve their own projects that were petitioned to them. This just clarifies that is done by that district board and not the state board. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to walk through this bill.
Thank you, Director Jashke. Next on my list for testimony, I have Sheila Vanney from the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. Please state your name for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Sheila Vanney, and I'm the Assistant Director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. MASWCD, excuse me, represents the state's 440 elected SWCD supervisors and our over 460 SWCD employees. And I want to just briefly offer our support for House File 1828 and thank Chair Hansen for bringing it forward. In particular, the changes to 103C.501 that were highlighted are excellent changes that are going to modernize and streamline our state cost share program and the system of contracts that has proven so successful as a tool for SWCDs to use to get conservation on the land with landowners. I also want to just take the opportunity to point out that we have in the audience with us today several participants in our MASWCD Leadership Institute. This is a cohort learning experience that spans a year, and every couple months they come together and learn about a different aspect of leadership. And so it's, some of it is instructional, some of it's hands-on learning, and then they bring those skills back to their local SWCDs and communities. And so I just wanted to give a shout out to those folks in the audience, SWCDs from across the state, as well as some agency partners from the Board of Water and Soil Resources and our federal partner, the Natural Resource Conservation Service. With that, Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vanney, and thank you to everyone who came to St. Paul to see how laws get made. Is there anyone else in the audience on that note that would like to testify for or against the bill? And with that, we will go to questions from members. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe Director Jaski could come back if it's okay.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. Just wanted to get on the record one way or the other. I'm not hearing anybody testifying against the bill today. Wondering if there's any known stakeholders that have been in contact with you or anyone else that you're aware of that does have any kind of concern. Not everybody's able to make it down for a hearing, so just wanted to confirm for the record.
Director Jaski.
Madam Chair, Representative Heintzman, no, we do not have anybody that's expressed any opposition to anything in the bill.
Thank you.
Further questions from members? Well, Representative Hansen, closing comments then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1828 is a comprehensive Bowser bill. We may consider moving this separately in the near future. Bowser did flag one provision, and Director Jaski mentioned on that it was in the repealers, and we'd like to keep the provision that provides for inspection. So I had wanted to retain that as a rule. We may be coming with language to have that clarified as a statute that gives the boards the responsibility for that. Mm-hmm. So that's the only change I think that's coming. And if we can get that resolved, maybe that. Otherwise, I renew my motion that it be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1828, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in a Bowser Bust or omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over. Next up, I'm not seeing Representative Hollins, and so we are going to proceed to House File 2774 related to the Sustainable Forest Resources Act. Chair Hansen, don't go anywhere. And in the meantime, would you like to move your bill?
I would move that House File 2774 be referred to Ways and Means, laid over for possible inclusion.
General Register?
General Register.
Great. Representative Hansen, to your bill.
House File 2774, if you look in your packet, there is a handy report to the governor on the Sustainable Forest Resources Act. I'd encourage you to look through that. But the purpose of this bill is to provide a vehicle for any future legislation, omnibus legislation, moving through during this session.
And I know you have Eric Schneck from the Minnesota Forest Resources Council on hand. Was Mr. Schneck looking to testify or just?
Just on hand, Madam Chair.
Great. Well, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 2774? Do we have questions from members? Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, just a question. Why don't we just repeal the sunset?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Brand. I think sunsets are good to come back and look at these provisions. This particular one, the reality is we're changing the sunset so we have a vehicle to use for an omnibus bill. And we felt that it would be relatively non-controversial.
Are there any further questions for the bill or the bill author? Well, Representative Hansen, closing comments?
I'd ask for your support.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 2774 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. And Representative Hollins is here. So I think we'll go to her bill, and I will hand the gavel back to Chair Hansen.
Representative Hollins, welcome to the committee. This is House File 2693. I will move that House File 2693 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And it looks like you have a DE1 amendment. I will move the DE1 amendment to the bill to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Representative Hollins, can you explain the changes in the amendment briefly?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, we're not going to offer the DE1 amendment today. There are some additional changes that need to be made, so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Then we can just move, if you could just explain the bill.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. I appreciate your time today. This bill has been in the making for several years. It is the Zero Waste Grant Bill. If you don't know, Minnesota is facing a waste crisis. One key piece of addressing that crisis is investing in an infrastructure to support zero waste economy. This bill creates a grant program for small businesses, nonprofits, and local governments to overcome startup barriers and support their efforts to create reuse systems, reduce waste, and contribute to a circular economy. In particular, the Zero Waste Grant Program will invest in source reduction and reuse, electronic source reduction and recycling, market development, recycling and composting infrastructure, and environmental justice areas and rural communities. It will be focused on, because at least 60% of grant funds are required to be spent on projects impacting environmental justice areas, and at least 30% of grant funds are required to be invested in rural Minnesota communities. When we were working on this grant, we were very purposeful in not giving specific requirements for what folks want to do, because we recognize that Minnesota is a big state and each different area faces different challenges in this zero waste issues. And so we want to make sure that it is accommodating any municipality, any nonprofit, local organizations to really be able to dig in and do the things that they need to do for their communities. We know that one size doesn't fit all, and so we're trying to bring the entire state of Minnesota along with us when we're doing the zero waste work. I have several testifiers, a couple of testifiers today, and I would love to have them come speak as well.
First up, Lucy Mullaney, Eureka Recycling. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, members of the committee, and Representative Hollins for her leadership on this issue. My name is Lucy Mullaney. I am the Director of Policy and Advocacy at Eureka Recycling. Amid historic supply chain disruptions, intensifying climate crisis, and rampant plastic pollution, there has never been a more important time to invest in a circular economy for Minnesotans that prioritizes reduction and reuse. As a mission-based recycler serving Minnesotans and engaging in national and international zero waste work for over 20 years, we can speak confidently to the fact that investments in zero waste infrastructure are investments in a strong, resilient economy, more stable supply chains, good green jobs, and a healthier environment. Our climate crisis is directly correlated to an economy that supports linear consumption over circularity. According to the EPA, 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from linear consumption. So that's production, transporting, using, and disposing of material goods. Waste reduction is a powerful climate strategy, and while composting and recycling are cornerstones of that work, there is nothing more impactful in terms of reducing toxics and carbon emissions than not creating more stuff in the first place. The systems of single-use packaging and linear consumption are well established. It is critical that we support opportunities to invest in and build out the alternatives. The Zero Waste Grant Program supports these alternatives. This could be as impactful as helping a school district purchase dishwashers and reusable dishes to move away from single-use disposables, or a central collection and washing station for refillable bottles for small manufacturers, or a community-scale composting program that reduces food waste and creates healthy soil for community gardens. This grant program will help communities get over startup hurdles and set up sustainable systems specific to their situation. Finally, we support the strong definitions laid out for the purposes of this grant program, including definitions for composting, recycling, reuse, and zero waste. These definitions ensure that we close loopholes on false solutions that currently exist in statute and create an opportunity for grant funds to target activities that achieve source reduction and bring us closer to zero waste. The program is an important step towards a more sustainable economy for Minnesota. We ask for your support and appreciate the consideration of our comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Emily Barker, Reuse Minnesota. Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Thank you. Chair Hansen, Representative Hollins, member of the committee. My name is Emily Barker. I'm the Executive Director of Reuse Minnesota, and I'm here today in support of House File 2693. Reuse Minnesota is a nonprofit dedicated to advancing reuse in our state. Our membership includes repair businesses, resale stores, and rental shops, as well as government entities, nonprofits, consultants, and individuals who support reuse. As we found in our 2022 impact study, Minnesota is home to more than 10,000 businesses that have reuse as a primary function or a significant portion of their business. These businesses account for over 45,000 jobs. Their work helps avoid CO2 emissions equivalent to 100,000 gas-powered vehicles being removed from the road on an annual basis. By the very nature of the work, reuse reduces the environmental impacts of all the stuff in our lives by cutting out the extraction of new materials and manufacturing of new products. Reuse businesses are also less likely to be exported, meaning the materials and jobs stay local, further reducing the impact of transportation and goods. Reuse decreases the amount of material heading to landfills, which have long-term environmental and financial costs for private waste companies, counties, and the state. This bill supports several aspects of the ever-expanding circular economy. In particular, Reuse Minnesota supports Subdivision 4 and 5 as they relate to reducing waste through design, developing markets for reused and refurbished goods, and educational programming to encourage reuse. Refurbishing and repurposing goods that still have much life left in them is critical to developing an economy that restores and regenerates the environment. Instead of sending usable goods to the trash, we create opportunities for economic prosperity through repair, rental, resale, and repurposing. One note, we would like to see the word reuse added to the language in Subdivision 5, so it is very clear that market development projects would be included for reuse businesses. In our impact study, we learned that reuse businesses generate around $5 billion of economic activity in Minnesota each year. We know that much of that economic activity generated through reuse comes from small businesses. We greatly appreciate the addition of small businesses as potential eligible entities in this year's bill. In a business needs assessment we conducted in 2022, many respondents noted the need for funding to support their growth into sustainable and flourishing businesses. The funding in this bill is an important investment that will help multiply existing economic activity along with the environmental and social benefits of reuse. In summary, reuse is good for Minnesota's environment, and we encourage your support of this bill today. Thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you. Marcus Mills, Community Power. Welcome. State your name for the record.
My name is Marcus Mills. I am representing both Community Power and the Minnesota Environmental Justice Table. Thank you. So, Chair Hansen and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 2693. My name is Marcus Mills. I work for Community Power. Community power is about people becoming energy decision makers, not just consumers. We need to keep our community's energy options open so we can secure a clean, locally controlled, equitable, affordable, and reliable energy and environmental future. We thank Representative Hollins for her leadership on this issue and introducing House File 2693, the Zero Waste Grant Program. Amid historic supply chain disruptions, the intensifying climate crisis, and rampant plastic pollution, there has never been a more important time to invest in a circular economy for Minnesotans that prioritizes reduction and reuse. Investments in zero waste infrastructure and investments in a resilient statewide economy, a healthier environment, and stable supply chains for Minnesota manufacturers. Our climate crisis is directly correlated with an economy that supports linear consumption over circularity. According to the EPA, 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from linear consumption, producing, transporting, using, and disposing of material goods. In 2017, more than 1.8 million tons of waste ended up in our state's landfills, and more than 1.3 million tons went to the incinerator. Yet with proactive legislative action, we can prevent this waste. According to the MPCA, nearly two-thirds of what is landfilled and burned in Minnesota could be reduced, reused, recycled, or composted with improved infrastructure. The systems of single-use packaging, linear consumption, and waste are well established, and it's critical that we support opportunities to invest in and build out the alternatives. This bill creates a grant program for small businesses, nonprofits, and local governments to create reuse systems, reduce waste, and contribute to a circular economy. This bill will source reduction and reuse, electronic resource reduction and recycling, market development, recycling, composting infrastructure, and environmental justice, and will concentrate on environmental justice and rural environmental justice areas in rural communities. The Zero Waste Grant Program prioritizes reuse and reduction. This could look like something as impactful as helping a rural school district purchase dishwashers and reusable dishes to move away from single-use disposables. Creating a central collection and washing station for refillable bottles, and it helps reduce food waste and creates healthy soils for urban gardens. This grant program will help communities get over some of the hurdles that are set up and set up sustainable systems specific to their situations. This program is a critical step forward toward a more sustainable economy in Minnesota. We ask for your support with this House File 2693 and appreciate your consideration for our comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Doug Carnival, National Waste and Recycling Association. Welcome and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, McGranchet Carnival Law Firm, representing the National Waste and Recycling Association. We're here to talk about this zero waste grant program that's being proposed. Minnesota has successful recycling and organics collection programs that have been led in part and principally by the commitment and investment of the private sector companies that collect, haul, and process organic and recycling waste materials across the state for many years. NWRA and its members generally are supportive of grant programs focusing on source reduction and market development. However, our members cannot support the distribution of public funds for the creation of recycling and composting infrastructure programs that will likely compete with privately owned assets that are currently serving many of the communities in the state. State funds should only be allocated for infrastructure projects that are necessary to fill the gaps in the existing system and should not be used to create publicly subsidized operations to compete with existing successful public-private partnerships. The bill would prevent the companies that have led the development of our current system from receiving any funds and would instead provide public funds to select few direct competitors that operate as nonprofits, small businesses, or local government entities. Additionally, we're concerned that the legislation creates some redundant and conflicting definitions of the terms that are already in statute, like recycling, composting, and a new definition of zero waste that we find to be problematic to meet. This legislation creates a process for reviewing grant applications that is also redundant. The MPCA already has established processes for reviewing grant applications. As part of this existing process, all solid waste projects receiving any type of funding are currently required to be analyzed for their impacts on public and private solid waste facilities that are in existence under Minnesota statutes and rules. Furthermore, infrastructure requests that may be appropriately handled by the capital bonding process rather than the appropriation process. In conclusion, we encourage you to limit the grant funding to source reduction and market development of projects, not infrastructure and equipment, and allow private and public partnerships to continue leading the development of needed solid waste infrastructure. We will look forward to working with Representative Hollins as this bill goes forward. We've submitted some written comments and encourage you to review them, and we thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. My name is Maria Jensen. I'm the Environment Health and Safety Specialist at Repowered, formerly known as Tech Dump, and I'm here to testify in support of House File 2693. Repowered is a nonprofit electronics recycler and refurbisher in the Twin Cities. We provide fair chances for people, the planet, and technology. Through our 18-month work readiness program, we provide job training opportunities for community members facing barriers to employment, such as experience with incarceration. Through our recycling and reuse efforts, we keep over 3 million pounds of electronics out of landfills and incinerators each year. By doing so, we protect our air and water from toxic pollution like mercury, lead, cadmium, polychlorinated biphenyls, and dioxins, just to name a few. Additionally, our activities reduce carbon emissions by just shy of 5,000 tons of CO2 equivalent per year. This the same savings of removing 1,000 motor vehicles from the road every year. That being said, we can do better. According to the 2021 score report from the MPCA, Minnesota only collects 23.7% of its electronics for recycling, leaving the majority to end up in landfills and incinerators. This bill would offer much needed funding to boost projects for recyclers in Minnesota and to build up their processing capacity, and by doing so, create more jobs within the circular economy. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone else? Okay. Members, testimony. Questions? Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Chair. I see that Assistant Commissioner Kadelka is here. Maybe he could pop down for a second.
Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Welcome and state your name for the record.
Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, just going through some of the letters that were written, one of them was summed up in testimony. Positive and negative, we're hearing from folks that have testified today. And if you could address some of the concerns that were mentioned and then maybe some of the positives, if there's a takeaway that you might have to offer the committee.
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the question. There's a lot here that is very similar to what's in the governor's bill, so we share the support of the need for developing our organics industries, our source reduction efforts, and others. And so in that way, this is a positive step moving forward. The agency does have some experience in offering grant programs in these areas, for instance, the market development. We are going to continue working with the author and supporters to see if we can streamline the grant process to make sure that it can be done well, much like our other programs. And we'll continue working with the author on advancing the needs for waste prevention, organics, and other activities that are in the bill.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Chair. So not necessarily trying to put you on the spot, but one of the comments was that some of the provisions of the bill are redundant. Some are maybe somewhat confusing and maybe already statutorily defined, and these definitions could conflict. Are any of those statements concerning to you, or is it something that we should discard?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there are some definitions here we'll continue to work with the author on, for instance, the issues of reuse and others, as mentioned. And so we're happy to continue to work with the author. Overall, the bill has the same goals. We're working towards the same areas of preventing waste from going to the disposal. And this would provide grants to many entities to help make that possible where it isn't today.
Members. Representative Hollins, to close.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. I just want to echo what the commissioner was saying. We've had a lot of really positive conversations and meetings about this bill, and I certainly don't see this as being the end. As you can see, the appropriation amounts are blank, so it clearly isn't the end for this piece of legislation, and we plan to continue working on it and making some edits and corrections to get it into the shape that we really want it to be. But I just want to close by saying I do think we've heard from a number of different municipalities, nonprofits, and businesses who say that this is something that they really need, and especially with the amount that we're looking at, which isn't a huge amount, but really makes a huge difference to organizations that otherwise are working on a shoestring budget. So just to be able to get some of those programs started, to you know, create pilot programs to see if this is something that is workable in their communities, I think that this could really be a tremendous asset for those organizations. So I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
I renew my motion that House File 2693 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the list is House File 2368 from Representative Hansen, Minnesota Swan Protection Act established. And Representative Hansen, would you like to move the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 2368, the Minnesota Swan Protection Act, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
And Representative Hansen, I believe you have the A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move the amendment and explain it?
Yes. Madam Chair, I would move the A1 amendment, and members, if you'd look at it, it really is redefining resting with protection. So wherever resting was, and this was, I believe, recommended from council. So I would move the A1 amendment.
Representative Hansen moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say no.
No.
The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, through your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The House File 2368, as amended, we passed off the House floor last year. This actually is the version that passed off. It is different than the bill that was introduced last year. The issue of lead in our lakes has been around for a while. There are bills that are proposing total bans. What this does is it takes a different approach, defines native swans as the Minnesota trumpeter swan and or a tundra swan, but does not include a mute swan. It defines designated swan resting areas. And why do we do that? Similar to designating lakes that may have AIS or designating lakes with other particular species, this would designate areas that are more considering of protection, that there would be limits put on the use of lead sinkers on those lakes. It also provides some provisions. It increases the restitution value for the illegal taking of a swan, a tundra swan, or a trumpeter swan, increases those, and it also defines the taking those swans in violation of game and fish laws as guilty of a misdemeanor, and there have been swans over recent years that have been taken. It appropriates money to provide for education. So we're not just providing the penalty, we're providing educational dollars to reach Minnesotans, and then provides $1 million from the general fund to the PCA for the lead tackle reduction program. So it's an incentive, it's education, and it does have a consequence as well. So I'd ask for your support. I know there are several testifiers.
The first one on my list is Carol Henderson. Welcome back to our committee. Mr. Henderson, please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to join you today and share some thoughts on the trumpeter swan, species that's very dear to me. I wrote up the original trumpeter swan introduction plan with Dr. Jim Cooper from the University of Minnesota in 1981. And it's been obviously successful beyond our wildest hopes. And so what I would like to do today is to share some thoughts on this whole issue of how we can provide for a long-term successful management of the swans, conservation of the swans, and some of the other species that they share habitats with, like loons as well. And so I'm looking at maybe a little bit bigger picture than this legislation proposes, but I would like you to think in terms of this big picture approach to an environmental issue that has dogged me. I picked up a dying bald eagle when I was the assistant manager at the Lackey Pearl Wildlife Refuge in November 1974. That was 49 years ago. And we're still dealing with lead poisoning today. We're still losing eagles. In 49 years, we haven't managed to get our arms around that problem. I hope it doesn't take another 49 years. I think we can agree that this issue has come far enough that we can agree that things are happening around us that are we may not be aware of, but I'm going to mention a couple of these today. One is that we have some people who refuse to buy into the argument that we need to use non-toxic fishing tackle or hunting ammo. They continue using lead. And what this is happening with is that it soils the reputation of hunters and anglers for people who can't understand why this is such a problem. Why is there such a resistance to this change? And so when this image is soiled, it takes away from the image of hunters and anglers as conservationists. They've often been very proud to feel, and I've been a hunter and angler since I was 10, we've been proud of that heritage of conservation. And now that heritage, that feeling of involvement with wildlife is slipping away from that from the public, who realizes that this is still a problem and that we need to leave the lead behind. And we need hunters and anglers to be leading that charge. They're the ones who can make the change happen. And there are some things changing, though, in the greater society around us. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency conducted a survey at the Midwest Sports Show just this past month. And they interviewed 237 people. And 86% of the respondents said it was important to deal with the issue of lead metal in fishing tackle. And 75% said they supported phasing out lead fishing tackle out of over 200 people. And then in greater Minnesota, the MPCA did a survey in 2019. And 65% of those people from greater Minnesota supported phasing out lead fishing tackle. So it's not like the public is opposing this, but we need to take a bigger picture and see what's good within society and for our sporting traditions. Now, sometimes there are alternatives, and tungsten for fishing tackle is a very interesting one. Do we have any people here from Bemidji today?
I don't believe so.
Oh, okay. Anyway, Northland Fishing Tackle is a nationally known manufacturer of fishing tackle out of Bemidji. And they've come up with a new line of jigs that they think is going to be a real game changer in terms of fishing tackle as an alternative to lead. They're very proud of these new products, and you might want to get briefed on them sometime to find out what they're doing. But it's a big move forward by the industry to say, this is where the future is. This is where we're going to be in 5 or 10 years. You need to catch up with us, because we're proud of our products. And the same thing is also happening with ammunition manufacturers. And Federal Cartridge locally has been a local leader for many years. And ammunition manufacturers across the country are in a race with each other to see who can come up with the best bullets. Now, this is an ad I just found this weekend in the latest Peterson's Hunting magazine by Seiko. The whole new line of copper bullets, and they're competing with all the other companies. So pass that around if you wish. But this is what's happening. We're in an era where industry realizes that we're in a non-lead future, and we need to be finding creative ways to change that attitude in terms of what I would consider a phase-in alternative. To say, how can we move this, not right away, but can we move it over time to get people used to the idea? In 2011, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did a survey, U.S. Hunting, Fishing, and Wildlife Associated Recreation, and they're repeating it again this year, that's 12 years later. They published the Minnesota report, and it said that the average Minnesota angler spends $1,620 per year, 2011, for fishing. Now, suppose the increased cost of the jigs they use went up a few dollars. Suppose an angler spent maybe an extra $40 a year for the alternative tackle, for the tungsten-based tackle. If it happened, that's less than 3% of the total amount that angler is spending per year. And that's just an excuse that we need to find out what the real reasons are and work with companies like our own to find out how we can keep promoting their products and find environmentally responsible and non-toxic products. And ever since I found that dying bald eagle, I've worked with trying to reduce eagle mortality through changing from lead, and also loon. I'm on the board of directors for the National Loon Center, trying to promote responsible loon conservation, protection, and management. And all of this surrounds an era in which I'm still an avid advocate for hunting and fishing. But we need to bring those issues together where we can all agree on what's the best strategy here. And now most recently, in the last few years, we've had issues with ammunition manufacturers and tackle manufacturers like Water Gremlin in White Bear Lake, and now recently in Federal with lead dust, and the people are bringing that home and they're getting it in the kids. We shouldn't be polluting our kids with lead. That's not necessary. We can get around it by using non-toxic alternatives as part of a partnership with the ammo and tackle industries. So if we can really deal with this, I guess I'm really excited about dealing with the trumpeter swan issue. Many of the lakes where they would be affected would also be lakes where loons would benefit from lack of lead. And then also we need to deal with how can we address the hunting issues with lead as well. Now, I was in the DNR back when we made the big transition from shot shells from lead for waterfowl hunting, and worked with Roger Holmes and Joe Alexander, and they did that transition over several years to say, we really need to do this. Well, there was a lot of complaining. People weren't happy with it. But you know what? The alternatives we have for non-toxic shot shells for waterfowl hunting are incredible today. They're really, really good. And also, now those companies are producing shot shells that are non-toxic for upland hunting. So they're kind of leading the charge, seeing that the future is there too. So I guess what I'd like to suggest here is that there might be some collaborative ways to incorporate consideration for swans as well as loons, maybe bald eagles, to say, how can we collaborate with our manufacturing industries and our marketing industries in Minnesota to promote our outdoor traditions, but doing it in a way where, say, maybe we've got eagle-safe rifle ammo, maybe we've got loon-safe or swan-safe fishing tackle. All of these things need to be brought together so it can be understood easily by people when they go shopping and they want to know at their local Joe's Sporting Goods or wherever what kind of tackle is available. Why is this one more expensive? Well, it's a little bit more expensive, but it's not going to kill loons. And that there's going to be a lot of young people who are going to buy into that. So I guess what I would like to suggest is that we don't need to wait many more years to make a decision on how we can take lead out of the formula of what we're doing in a society, because lead is a cumulative poison. We're putting more lead out there in terms of fishing tackle and ammo every year in our lakes and wildlands, many tons. It just keeps accumulating. It never goes away. It's still there. There's still lead in the soil from the Civil War. Those bullets never degenerated. And so I guess what I would like to do is just to say there are some things that are, you know, this is a very honorable first step for helping the swans, and I'm very pleased about that. And I checked with the Minnesota Ornithologists Union this past week. They said we have now swans nesting in at least 71 counties out of 87 in Minnesota, and there's other counties where they haven't been documented yet. But they've made an incredible comeback. But now we have to look after taking care of them and making sure that, you know, they're adequately protected. But I think that there are a couple of definitions in here, like what is critical habitat. I'm not sure what the word critical means. We need to take a look at that. And then migration corridors, I don't know that that's legally defined anywhere. So there needs to be a little tweaking of the wording in the bill. And then I think the most problematic issue is county-by-county approval. There needs to be a way of building support for this in a way that doesn't drive the bill down and create so much chaos, I guess I would say, or dissension about which lakes are going to be affected, which ones wouldn't. If we have to do this, it needs to be in a collaborative manner that I think if we can tweak that and bring it into a level where we can get conservation groups agreeable on how they can support this type of conservation, how we can look after the swans. There's nothing more sickening than coming upon, let's say, a dying eagle, a dying swan, a dying loon, and you realize there's nothing you can do. All you can do is just wait for it to die and then put it in the freezer. I've seen this far too many times in my 44 years with the DNR, and most of the time it was not because they were being illegally shot or injured, or maybe it was an accident, but when you see these dying for a reason that's really not necessary, we can eliminate the lead poisoning as a whole issue, not just for swans, but for loons, for bald eagles, for golden eagles, for many other species, and then also from that incidental input where people who shoot deer with lead bullets butcher their deer, they take it home and they feed it to their spouse and their kids, and they never tell the people what kind of bullet they used. If more spouses ask, what kind of bullet did you shoot my deer with, and I have to cook it now, I think there'd be a lot of spouses throwing that deer in the garbage because it would contain lead fragments. And that's something that we need to realize, that if we're serious about R3 in the DNR recruiting young hunters and young anglers, we don't want to be teaching them to spread more lead in the environment. So all of these things, you know, in the big picture of my 44 years, I had a lot to share here today, but I just want to suggest that I really appreciate what Representative Hansen is accomplishing here, and if there's anything I can do to participate in your discussions, I'm happy to do so, except I'm going to be spending the first half of April in Trinidad.
Well, hopefully we'll have our discussion today, so don't go too far. And next on my list for testimony is Don Tanner. And thank you for your testimony, Mr. Henderson. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Tanner. Please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Thank you. Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dawn Tanner, and I work as the Program Development Coordinator at the Badness Lake Area Water Management Organization. I'm here because an important part of my job has been collecting a lot of these swans that Carol Henson mentioned and when they are dying of lead poisoning, it's highly visible. So I'm here. I want to thank you for bringing forward the Swan Protection Act, House File 2368. I think that this is an excellent step in protecting our environment and our wildlife from lead sinkers by designating swan resting areas, increasing education, and offering lead tackle exchanges to non-lead safe alternatives. I've been part of this effort to collect swans. We're collecting data and reporting about swan deaths due to lead poisoning at a single location since 2019. We've had at least 26 swans that have died at Badnesucker Lakes Regional Park in Badness Heights. The most recent one was last Tuesday. The Ramsey County took on an effort to try to capture that swan and bring it in where it may have been able to receive help. As Carol mentioned also, usually by the time people are seeing these swans that are dying of lead poisoning, it's too late to do anything. That swan died. But people got out there, they got involved, and they tried to do something. And I really appreciate what you are trying to do here today, too. This location is important because it focuses swan activity during the winter months when it's coldest, because the water doesn't freeze over, because our drinking water for St. Paul and surrounding communities is being pumped through this area. That's what keeps the water open, and that's what focuses the swan activity at this location. It's shallow in the channel, and the swans, as they're concentrated there, are picking up this lead tackle. As Carol mentioned, lead accumulates over time. It's accumulating in our drinking water. When the swans die and we aren't able to get to them, that lead has been mobilized into their body tissues. It's being put directly back into our drinking water. The Minnesota DNR, Ramsey County, and the Vadnais Lake Area WMO all receive calls regularly from concerned citizens who see these swans dying a slow and highly visible death. Citizens contact us with the hope that the swans can be successfully treated. In reality, even if the swans are successfully captured and transported, they usually do not survive because the lead poisoning is too far advanced. These deaths are preventable. Safe economic alternatives to lead tackle are available, and I thank you for taking this step to work to protect our swans at Badnesucker Park and other locations in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Tanner. Next on my list for testimony is Dr. Dale Gentry, Conservation Manager, Audubon, Minnesota. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Gentry. Please restate your name for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Dale Gentry. I'm the Director of Conservation for Audubon, Minnesota. Trumpeter swans were once one of the rarest birds in the world. In 1935, there were 69 known individuals in the United States. And at that point, either they'll go extinct or they will rebound. And fortunately, with the protection against hunting, a population has rebounded. And we're delighted to see them now nesting in our lakes in Minnesota. That should be a word of encouragement to us that we can recognize the cause of problems, we can come up with solutions, and we can have positive conservation outcomes. And as we study the populations of our native swans, tundra swans and trumpeter swans, in areas where they coexist with high human use of activities like fishing, what we find are that is that lead poisoning is the number one cause of death. And we heard that testimony about what's happening at Badness Lake in Badness Heights. And that is exactly the story that the science supports as well. And so Audubon is excited about this positive step in the protection of trumpeter swans, which are a species of special concern for the Minnesota DNR. And we believe that this act would benefit not only swans, trumpeter swans and tundra swans, but numerous other waterfowl and loons. And as Carol pointed out, there is no safe amount of lead in a bird's system. And so when they ingest these sinkers and jigs, which they mistake for the little stones that they eat to help them digest their food, just one of those is enough to kill a very large bird like a swan. So we are aware of the problem. We have viable solutions since we already have a great supply of non-toxic tackle available. And so we ask for your support to help make that change in how we recreate in our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Okay. First on my list is Representative Liz Lagarde.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if it's for the last testifier, but You said the swans have rebounded. What is the population of the swans, the estimate?
Dr. Gentry?
That's a great question, and I'm afraid I don't know the answer to it. When their population was as low as it was, there were no swans in Minnesota for a while. You know, that they can only go up. But as Carol said, they're now breeding in a majority of the counties in Minnesota. The population is increasing, and we're happy to see that, but their population is not at a place where we're comfortable with, you know, a stable long-term population just yet.
Representative Lislegard.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a way that we could kind of just find out, or, you know, somebody could give us a rough estimate?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep.
All right,
yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. Very supportive of the bill. I have a few questions. More of an education person here and health policy, but there is a health component to this that's really interesting. So swans are dying, and many of the testifiers were talking about lead being in the water. And I'm reading some of the letters from sportsmen, sports fishers, saying they have concerns. I guess I have a few questions. Is I see that New York, Maine, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire all have really limited lead tackle. How many waters would be impacted by this? Because I'm very supportive of that. It looks like there's alternatives. So I guess I'll start with that question, and then I have another one.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we provide the authority to the DNR to designate those areas. So at this moment, we can't tell you that. We want to use science as the driver on it. And that's why the bill has the component for education and also the $1 million for the providing the alternatives for the tackle. And some of those alternatives, just to maybe reference Representative Lislegard, you know, they may be tungsten. When you're talking about ammunition, that may have been copper, those types of other metals.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, well, that's helpful. I guess there must be patterns in which swans work, and I don't know a great deal about that. Maybe you could just tell me a little bit more.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and maybe I would ask Mr. Henderson to come forward because he is the expert.
Mr. Henderson, would you be willing to come educate us?
And that recovery effort that has occurred, I would just note, if there's one person responsible, it's Carol Henderson.
Can you repeat the question again, please?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. My question was in terms of how the DNR is going to determine which water the swans will be using so that they know which ones are protected. What are the patterns look like for swans so that we would know as a committee?
Mr. Henderson.
Okay. Well, the patterns are going to be confusing at first, to say the least. The trumpeter swans require about 4 years to maturity. So they'll pair up maybe when they're two, they'll spend a year with their partner when they're three, and when they're four, then they'll start nesting. So during those first couple of years, there are groups of swans, could be 30, 50, 60 or more swans, and flocks of what you might call the teenager swans, just moving around the state and visiting different places, checking out marshes where they might nest someday. And so in terms of their local movement behavior for the subadult swans, they're going to be very mobile. And it isn't what you would call a traditional migration in the terms of flying south and north. The swans do migrate in the fall, usually quite late in the fall. They may go down to Iowa, Arkansas, Missouri, some of the more southeasterly but more central states. They don't go too far south. But the other thing is that some of the swans stay around through the winter wherever there's open water. If you have a reservoir with a water plant or along a river, then some of the swans will stay here throughout the winter. They don't truly migrate, but they might migrate, say, from northern Minnesota down to, you know, they used to go in big numbers to Monticello. But they might go to the St. Croix River and other places. So all of these movements really confuse the issue of what we call migration. And these shuttling movements that the birds do during the year are going to make it complicated in terms of how do you monitor or map the use of the swans on these different wetlands. Are they using it more in the fall or the winter, spring? All of this is going to require an incredible amount of documentation, which will be a big challenge. And so I guess that's one of the reasons why I think this would be a daunting challenge for people who are trying to figure out, you know, what are the lakes or places where this would be more enforceable or more desirable for the benefit of the swans.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would support a full transition to more eco-friendly options. But of course, I'm sure that there's lots of resistance to this, as other states probably have witnessed. I guess the last question I just want to know is, with the lead tackle collection program, how exactly is that going to work? And then I'll be done.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, I believe we have the Pollution Control Agency was here earlier, but Mr. Johnson.
I'll let the folks from the Pollution Control Agency fight it out. Okay, I see Mr. Johnson's coming down. And Representative Edelson, I would, there has been legacy grants that have gone towards some of that tackle collection, and there are lots of organizations that do tackle exchanges, including one in your district, I believe, at Bush Lake with the Isaac Walton League. So they might have some good resources for you. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Tom Johnson, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We have an existing Get Out the Lead program. It's very successful in providing areas for folks to drop off lead tackle if they should so wish to help remove that from the system if they're doing their own transition. So that's a voluntary program. Certainly, this funding would help expand collection sites, et cetera. I can follow up with the committee on a more comprehensive overview of the program if that's helpful.
I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would be nice to get the agency tasked with so many of the duties and enforcement to speak to the bill. So could DNR come down?
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and then we'll go back to Representative Heintzman for the question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Katie Smith, Director of the Ecological and Water Resources Division at Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for coming down. There's just a number of specific directions in the bill. I just was wondering if you've read through it and if you have any observations that could be helpful to the committee.
Sorry, Director Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Heintzman, the recovery of trumpeter swans in Minnesota has been a remarkable conservation success, as other testifiers have mentioned. Maybe to Representative Lissegaard's question, the 2019 waterfowl survey estimated the trumpeter population in Minnesota to be 23,000. They are regular and widely distributed breeders across the state in virtually every county. Trumpeter swans continue to expand their range and dramatically increase in number, but they do still face threats to their population and are a state-listed species of concern. Tundra swans migrate through Minnesota and frequently congregate in large numbers along the Mississippi River in the fall. Some specific comments and questions on the bill. Swan protection area is not explicitly defined. However, the entire state is part of the swan migration corridor in the central Mississippi flyways. Therefore, many of Minnesota's most popular fishing lakes would be impacted by a lead sinker ban on waters. And DNR could make a map available, but it'll be this map I could provide to committee members. Sinkers do have non-toxic alternatives, but availability may be limited, particularly, you know, considering the size of this impacted area. Implementation and operations will be costly expenses for the DNR, many of which would be ongoing for assessment and designation of waters for the presence of swans, public engagement, and compliance with the non-toxic requirement. The DNR did not receive a fiscal note request for this particular bill, but for a similar bill last year, the cost was estimated at $5 million. But we'd be glad to continue talking to the author about these items.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. An additional question is more of a personal one. I've got a number of nesting pair that have been frequently on the pond in front of my home. And I'm just curious if my observation is something that is normal or of any concern whatsoever. I probably could ignore it to some extent. But for many, many years, I had nesting loons on my lake. And as soon as I found or observed trumpeting swans there, that changed. Is it? And they're gone. So I'm wondering, is there any negative interactions? We all love swans. I love seeing them, and so there's part of me that's indifferent to it. But if there is an impact, or if we are observing a negative impact, are we tracking that?
Director Smith?
Madam Chair, Representative Heintzman, I can't speak to your exact concern. We do receive complaints in the non-game wildlife program about, you know, swan damage of crops, including like commercial wild rice harvest, but I can look into that question and get back to you.
Would perhaps Dr. Gentry know the answer to that?
So,
Dr. Yes. Gentry.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairperson and committee. Swans, like most species, are territorial against their own species, but tend not to be competitive with other species, presumably because they're not competing for the same food source. That's not to say that it couldn't happen, but it would be, I think, uncommon since they aren't competing for food.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. Is there any research that you could cite that I could look at so I could kind of dive into that a little bit? Because I am wondering what happened in my own,
yeah,
on my own pond, and it's been something that's been confirmed as I've visited with other folks that have observed similar behavior.
Yeah, I would be happy to look into it for you and share with you what I find, and can recommend some places to look for that for further information on your own as well. Yep.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple of things for the committee to consider, and you know, it'd be nice to have the facts as we're understanding, you know, the impacts of the legislation. That sounds like there are a few things, Representative Hansen, that we should probably be looking a little more closely at, including maybe the definition of the lead sinkers specifically. But we can talk about that offline.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Happy to be looking at tweaks and changes. You know, Carol Henderson providing suggestions, I think, is very helpful, as well as the DNR and the other scientists. We want to make sure that this is scientifically sound, as well as being effective for the taxpayer as well. So happy to look at that. It is being laid over so we can work on it.
Great. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps Mr. Henderson, if I have a question for you. Thank you. One of the things I guide canoe trips up in the wilderness, and I did a paper on these in eighth grade, the endangered species of the loon, and that was in the 70s, so that's dating myself. But I've always been fascinated with the trumpeter swan. The trumpeter swan has been like the comeback kid. It was gone, and now it's here. Last year during the floods up in Rainy Lake, I flew a beaver airplane from Ely up there. I quit counting at 50 nesting.
Wow.
There's white in every pond, everywhere. They have found a home. You know, I guide canoe trips on Crooked Lake for 40-plus years. Never saw a swan in the last 6 years. There's nesting pairs. There's they do chase geese. The geese don't. There's competition there. There right now, as we speak, there are swans on Shagwa River in Ely. They're up there early. They're getting earlier and earlier and earlier. We used to have nesting pairs on Ella Hall, the first ones that we ever saw up there, and now there's families of them. They are very successful, and they adapt. It seems like they adapt. But I like Representative Heintzman, I'm curious about the interaction with ducks, with geese and with loons for him, if you have an answer, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. You've asked some really good questions and brought up some interesting facts here. One is that the swans are much more intolerant of the Canada geese, so they will tend to drive those out of their territory. But when I was collecting trumpeter swan eggs in Alaska back in 1986, 70, 87, and 88, we flew in on float planes, we taxied up to the trumpeter swan nest, and then I got out in my chest waders and sometimes sunk in and sometimes didn't, and collected the eggs. We would leave two live eggs in the nest and take the rest for bringing back to Minnesota. In two cases, the loons and the swans were nesting within 25 to 30 feet of each other. And I think what was happening is that the loon was benefiting from the much larger territorial defense of that area, so that if some creature came into that territory, the swan chased away the creature, the bear or whatever it was, and the loon just hunkered down and let the swan do all the work. So at least that was my hypothesis for why they would tolerate each other so closely. So I don't have any direct evidence of any competition between the two, because they do have quite a different lifestyle in terms of their food habits and so forth. So I guess I'm not sure what might have been going on at the lake where you were, where the maybe there were different territorial requirements for the birds that were involved there. And maybe that's just an adaptation that's happened in Alaska, where there's kind of a peaceful coexistence where the loons benefit from having swans on their lake. So that would be my initial response to what was going on there.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Henderson. You can stay there. Representative Brand.
Yeah, just an observation. When we're talking about swans, and it's really important to point out all the work that was done to kind of bring swans back to Minnesota. It was in the 1930s that there was about 70 swans left in the 48 states, right? And in the 1880s in Minnesota, swans disappeared altogether.
Right, about 1883, 84.
Over harvesting. Now we've got Swan Lake Township in Stevens County. We've got Swan Lake. There's a big Swan Lake near Dassel where my grandparents used to have a lake home. I've got a Swan Lake, which is the largest prairie pothole in the United States. That's in Nicollet County. There's a Swan Lake in the Boundary Waters Canoe area. We've got swan lakes and swan names everywhere, but for a very long time in Minnesota, we had no swans. And so I think it's really important to say that, you know, we've got about 30,000 swans now in Minnesota, and it's due to an awful lot of conservation work, an awful lot of work to get these things accomplished to bring these folks back, these swans back. And so I just wanted to recognize that and say there was a time. There was none.
Right. And I appreciate that, those comments very much. I would mention that since we initiated the project, we've had Minnesota swans disperse into North and South Dakota, southeastern Manitoba, southwestern Ontario. And so they are also benefiting from those Minnesota swans because of the dispersal that's been going on with the species. So it's been... the people from Manitoba took me up there in the early 2000s to say, what lakes would be good ones where we can reintroduce swans? And I said, you don't need to reintroduce anything. They're going to find their way there, and they'll be free. And they did. So it's been a really nice success story, and hopefully we can experience a few more nice successes along the way.
Thank you, Representative Brand and Mr. Henderson, for your testimony and all of your years of work on this. Representative Hansen, would you like to make any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a different bill from what was introduced last year. I expect that what we put in the omnibus bill will be different than the bill that's in front of us based on the testimony that's here. But the intent is to have a comprehensive bill that provides education, incentives, a consequence for poaching, but also try to protect swans through a scientific manner. I'd ask for your support, and I renew my motion that House File 2368, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 2368, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Last on our agenda today is House File 2761. Representative Hansen, would you like to move this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move House File 2761 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
And Representative Hansen, I believe there is an A2 author's amendment. Would you like to explain that amendment and move it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, the A2, I move the A2 amendment, and what this does is it removes the appropriations for the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health, and it also clarifies that it's all within the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. What this does is it will result in the bill not having to go to Chair Vang's committee or to Chair Liebling's committee. And I would ask for your support.
Representative Hansen moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Heinzman.
I was hoping to have an opportunity prior to the amendment going on, but we've passed that.
We can talk about the amendment when we talk about the bill. Representative Hansen to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So we have, with the amendment, Representative Heinzman, we have deleted Section 5, the biomonitoring, and on page 3, deleted Subdivisions 1 and Subdivision 3. So there would not be a biomonitoring provision for the Department of Health, and there would not be a provision for the Department of Ag for doing the grain assessment. So what that leaves is the commissioner, PCA, must sample and test dried distillers grains and other ethanol, biodiesel, and advanced biofuel co-products for the presence of neonicotinoids and perfluoral polyfluoral substances. And what's left in the bill after the amendment is that would be for air and for water. And why is this bill here? Members in Chair Vang's committee, we had testimony that PFAS are in several pesticides. And we've had bill after bill after bill in this committee about PFAS. And so what this says is if we have PFAS and pesticides, and PFAS are persistent chemicals, and we also have evidence of neonicotinoids being persistent pesticides throughout the plant where they are applied as a seed treatment, it would be prudent for us to look at biofuels on where they're being produced, where those products are being used as a feedstock. As I have discussed with the Pollution Control Agency, since the amendment has been drafted, it appears that it would be very difficult for air monitoring at this time. And so it would be my intent, as this is laid over, that this would be for really looking at wastewater discharge with the existing permits to look for neonicotinoids and PFAS at these plants. And I know there are several testifiers.
There are, and first on the list is Brian Warner from the Minnesota Biofuels Association. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Warner. Please restate your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Chair Hansen and members of the committee, my name is Brian Warner and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on our association's concerns with House File 2761, legislation to require monitoring and testing for treated seed and PFAS at biofuel facilities. I want to be very clear. No ethanol plant in the state of Minnesota accepts pesticide-treated seed corn as a feedstock for biofuel production. Guidance released by the Pollution Control Agency and Department of Agriculture in March 2022 specifically prohibits treated seeds from being used for ethanol, biodiesel, or other fermentation or oil processing. If an individual facility hypothetically decided to move forward with utilizing treated seed as a feedstock, they would be required to obtain a permit from MPCA, which would include subsequent monitoring, testing, and reporting. Biofuel plants across the state of Minnesota are highly committed to following all federal and state laws, regulatory requirements, guidance, and protocols to protect against the unintentional introduction of treated seed corn into ethanol into the ethanol production process. Ethanol production facilities inspect all grain shipments upon arrival and reject any inbound shipment if treated seed corn is detected. Furthermore, in addition to state guidance and permitting, the Federal Food Safety Modernization Act requires ethanol production facilities to adopt current good manufacturing practices and preventative controls to ensure the safety of co-products that are used in animal feed. All ethanol production facilities are inspected annually to ensure compliance with FSMA safety plans, which include protocols for testing distillers' grains and corn oil, as well as restrictions on where those products can be sold if contamination is found. Finally, with respect to PFAS monitoring and testing, methods for determining the presence of PFAS in air emissions, biofuel, and biofuel co-products are still undergoing thorough testing and have yet to be validated by the federal EPA. We have concerns about subjecting ethanol production plants to monitoring requirements based on draft testing methods that have not been through a complete federal rulemaking process. The use of non-validated methods will lead to test results that do not accurately reflect the presence of PFAS. I will close by saying that we share a common goal, the protection of Minnesota's environment and the public health of its residents. That's why the focus of the biofuel industry in Minnesota has been the safe and efficient production of renewable fuels, which are helping to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and improve our air quality. We are committed to working with Representative Hansen and the rest of the committee to eliminate chemical pollution in a meaningful and constructive way that isn't duplicative of existing state and federal guidelines and regulations. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Joe Smentek from the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. Welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. As stated, my name is Joe Smentek. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Biodiesel Council. Mr. Youngerberg, who is their Executive Director, has been under the weather and was not able to join tonight. I'm mostly here in my role assisting the Biodiesel Council to bring a little light to this bill. As Mr. Warner mentioned, there are right now draft water testing and some air testing things going on at EPA, but there are no approved methods as of right now at EPA to do the testing for this. For the feedstocks in the biodiesel industry, we don't accept seeds at all. The biodiesel plants in the state of Minnesota accept oils. There is nothing that comes out of a biodiesel plant that is marketed as a commercial feed. We don't have DDGs like an ethanol plant. So the crushing is done at a biodiesel or a soybean crush plant where you'll get meal and you'll get oil. The USDA, FDA have never found PFAS or neonics in the soybean oil. The hexane extraction process that it undergoes none of those chemicals have been found to survive that process. The soybean seeds themselves that are being crushed, when they do need to use a neonic treated seed, has minimal residue or maximum residue levels that are enforced by USDA for export standards. In the seed themselves, those levels are found and marketed as less than 0.01 parts per million, which is the lowest level they can give and is virtually indetectable. So we have concerns about subjecting Minnesota's biofuel plants, biodiesel, renewable hydrocarbon diesel, and sustainable aviation fuel plants, if we do get those latter two plants in the state, to these testing requirements, as these chemicals are not present in our seed in the first place. Further, the California Health and Safety Code, Section 57004, requires multimodal evaluations. Those multimodal evaluations have found that biodiesel and renewable hydrocarbon diesel are no worse than, and in most metrics, better for environmental impacts and public health than petroleum diesel. In no instance has either of the chemicals been found in either one of those fuels in the state of California under their low-carbon fuel standard. So in summary, I would hope that you guys would follow the science, as was stated with the Swan bill, and not impose this unnecessary testing for chemicals that are not present in the feedstocks that go into biodiesel plants. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Last on my list is Chris Cowan from the Pesticide Action Network. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Cowan. Please restate your name for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Cowan, and I'm a contract lobbyist with the Pesticide Action Network. Generally, our work is to try to keep people safe from the use of pesticides and our environment and pollinators included. Just a few comments about the bill. We speak in favor of House File 2761. One of the letters submitted to committees brings up the point that there's the presence of PFAS is nearly universal, and I don't find that beginning point for an argument to be very reassuring that it is everywhere. So we need to look for it where it is. I don't think looking for it in ethanol plants is irresponsible. What if it turns out that folks in ethanol plants are exposed more to PFAS than other places? My concern with this use of the word irresponsible, I need to touch on this, is what happened in Mead, Nebraska and the ethanol plant there. And what happened there isn't a one-off thing. It's true, it's one ethanol plant, and as the letter says, one out of two in the country. But by their own promotion marketing, the owners of the plant said that 98% of the treated seed in North America went to that plant, and they had long-term contracts with large agricultural entities, most of whom have ties to the state of Minnesota when you're talking about what they refer to, and that those same entities, those same companies, have spent, according to court documents, $28 million in the last 2 years trying to clean up the mess in Mead, Nebraska. I'm sorry, but I think it's irresponsible to ignore that record, because when you look at it day after day, month after month, year after year, from about 2015 to 2021, millions of pounds of treated seed went to a single ethanol plant in Mead, Nebraska, where it was burned to make ethanol, and they tried to sell the feedstock. And then they tried to dispose of the feedstock on their own grounds. And now six companies have voluntarily decided that they would lead the effort to try to clean that all up under the law in Nebraska. I think as long as we're in the shadow of that, we do need to be very careful to be looking at neonics and PFAS in ethanol plants. As far as being ahead of the EPA, I think Minnesotans should be proud that as far as PFAS goes, I think we've been ahead of the EPA for quite a while, and I think that the residents of Washington and Ramsey counties are very happy that the state of Minnesota is ahead of the EPA. It was yesterday that the EPA came out with the standards for PFAS in drinking water, and 4 units out of a trillion being the standard. So there was just reference here to 0.01 units out of a million. Well, I can't do the math off the top of my head, but that's a lot more than four units out of a trillion. So the last point that I'll make is that there's still, the Pollution Control Agency did come out with a fact sheet that covers some of this, but if you go to the Pesticide Environmental Stewardship website, like I did today, and look at some of the advice that they give on how to deal with treated seed, number 4 in their list of dealing with large quantities of pesticide-treated seed, they have fermentation in an alcohol-producing process at an ethanol plant. Some ethanol plants may be able to use treated seeds in the fermentation process. And then it goes on to say, in addition, some ethanol plants may be able to use treated seed as an alternate power source. So in light of PFAS, in light of the record in Mead, Nebraska, and how long that went on, I think it's totally appropriate that something like House File 2761 be enacted into law so that Minnesotans and others can rest assured that there is no problems with what's going on in those plants. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, I will go to Representative Heintzman.
So I'm going to point to subdivision 9. It's on page 1. Just had a quick question for Representative Hansen. I see advanced biofuel co-products in line 1.12, and then in 1.13, I'm seeing commercial feed is mentioned. Is that not something that is directly connected to agriculture and potentially in the jurisdiction of the Agriculture Committee?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Heintzman. And that was my error in the amendment, that subdivision 9 is supposed to be deleted because that ties back to the part on subdivision 1, section 6. So that ag portion, they would be looking at the feedstock. That would be my intent to strike that. So what you would have left of the bill is section 2, subdivision 12, where the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System disposal permit is being looked at. So really it's going to be looking at wastewater. And then it would have the life cycle analysis or the assessment on page 3, and that would be to the commissioner of PCA. That was in the change in the amendment. In consultation with the commissioner of Ag, a life cycle assessment of the presence of neonicotinoid pesticide in the production of ethanol, biodiesel, advanced biofuel, including feedstocks. So essentially that is a study.
Representative Heintzman.
No further questions, thank you.
Further questions from members? Representative Hansen, closing comments then.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill, as you can see, we've taken some comments, take those seriously, take the testimony seriously, and we will continue to lay this over for possible inclusion. I renew my motion that 2761 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 2761 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And the bill is laid over. Members, we've concluded our business for the day. I think there will be more communication about further meetings. And with that, we are adjourned.